So why don't we dive right in by interpreting one of the easiest events in the last 20 years of American history. Now, can someone tell me why in 1975 we pulled our troops out of Vietnam?
The failure of Vietnamization to win popular support caused an ongoing erosion of confidence in the various American but illegal Saigon regimes.
Is she right? Because I know that's the popular version of what went on there. And a lot of people like to believe that. I wish I could, but I was there. I wasn't here in a classroom, hoping I was right, thinking about it. I was up to my knees in rice paddies with guns and Edwards going up against Charlie, slugging it out with him, while pussies like you were back there partying, putting headbands on, doing drugs, listening to the goddamn Beatle albums.
You know what it's like to gut up to this and go out every day and go past the peer pressure and come out day one and say 9/11 was an inside job and lose most of the radio stations I was on? You know what it's like to go to sleep every night knowing you work for a bunch of psychotic killers and you bastards are probably going to end up killing me one day? You know what it's like knowing you've ruined my life? You know what it's like, you sons of bitches? I'm tired of your crap!
Hey, Professor, take it easy, will you? I mean, these kids, they were in grade school at the time. And me, I'm not a fighter. I'm a lover.
Well, I didn't know you wanted to get involved with the discussion, Mr. Helper.
Hey, everybody, this is Brett. Welcome back to the podcast. I'm being joined by a familiar voice. You've heard him on the show several times in the past from TragedyandHope.com, Tony Myers. How are you doing tonight, Tony?
I'm doing well, Brett. How are you doing tonight?
Very good. We have a big topic in front of us here. I wanted to spend a few minutes discussing why we are doing this show. What is the utility of this podcast? I think first and foremost, to be quite honest, it is timely. For those of you who do not know, Alex Jones appeared on the Piers Morgan show on CNN. Piers Morgan has really been cranking up the volume on this gun control debate over the course of the last couple months. This really started after the shooting in Aurora, Colorado, but the vitriol of this discussion was cranked up again after the recent shooting in Connecticut. Alex Jones appeared for about 13 minutes. He was supposed to be on for three segments. He was actually cut from the third segment. He did, in my opinion, just about everything wrong that a person supposedly trying to make the case for freedom and self-defense could possibly do. It makes it very easy to do the division fallacy when the next day on his radio show, after this, frankly, this embarrassment on Piers Morgan, Alex declared himself to be the leader of the Liberty Movement.
I never wanted to be the real leader of the Liberty Movement. Ron Paul is more of a statesman, but he's 76, 77 now. What is he, 76? Look up his age. And unfortunately, for all intents and purposes, I am the leader.
And I had this concern going all the way back to July. We did an After School Sucks special on this topic. The title of that show was, Is Alex Jones Disinformation on Purpose or Just by Accident? And I expressed this concern that it looked like Alex Jones was in many ways becoming synonymous with many things outside of mainstream thinking. So it was very easy for someone to just say, oh, you're one of those Alex Jones InfoWar characters. That fallacy becomes much easier to commit when Alex Jones declares himself to be the leader of a liberty movement. What we're hoping to do today, as far as utility is concerned, is to provide some talking points and some strategies for distancing yourself logically and rhetorically from Alex Jones. I think that while this continues to be a hot topic of discussion, one of the worst traps that a person can be put into from a persuasion standpoint is the position where they have to defend what Alex Jones did on Piers Morgan against Piers Morgan. And I do, of course, before we go any further, want to clarify, I do not know what the purpose of Alex Jones is. I have raised this question, is Alex Jones some kind of disinformation agent? And I feel like those suspicions are well-founded, but I do not have any concrete proof of that. And I really find this to be a troubling issue that I'm looking to explore tonight with Tony. But I wanted to start with this because, as I said to you earlier in the day, Tony, I spent some time going through Alex Jones' videos on YouTube looking for some kind of human moment. And I think one of the things that's just so absent from a lot of these debates, whether we're having them with people on Facebook or we're watching them in the mainstream media or we're even having them with each other, is a willingness to look at somebody else's humanity, to see what's really alive in them. And Alex Jones is somebody who claims to be a leader of a quote-unquote liberty movement. And when I think of the word liberty, I often think of that as a personal pursuit, an intellectual pursuit. And when I see somebody who is so consumed, seemingly consumed by fear and anger and blame, to me, you know, that's not liberty. Liberty is not the return of a government that follows a constitution. So we did talk about this clip where he's lamenting the threat he feels after, you know, this exposure on CNN. He said he felt threatened personally. He felt like his family was being threatened. You mentioned something, there was kind of these veiled threats towards his family and towards him the next night on CNN.
I believe it was on CNN, yes. And it was actually Aaron Dyke, someone who works under him, who I enjoy Aaron Dyke's work. He's much more calm and cool and collected in the way he presents himself. But, you know, whether you're independent media, whether you're mainstream media, it's very easy to give into a sort of polemic from our emotions. You know, in one way, we're getting this kind of either or fallacy. Sometimes it's sort of the fallacy, it's a dichotomy fallacy, where you can only choose one or the other side without viewing all of the information that would otherwise, like you said earlier, in this case, a division fallacy, where he's declaring himself a leader. But what's true of the, if I remember correctly about division, it goes from reasoning from the whole to the part. And we're saying that he's the leader of the whole libertarian movement. Everyone else is following him, behind him. Now, libertarian leader to me is somewhat oxymoronic, meaning they're contradictory words placed next to each other in order to complement one another. Mm-hmm. If anything, unless it has to do with your own personal freedom. And I think as libertarians or people who espouse those sorts of values, we're talking about a libertarian leader, sure, doesn't have to be oxymoronic as long as we're talking about our own individual values. Now, when he's saying that he's the leader of a collective movement, that's a bit troubling. And it's interesting how he goes on this Piers Morgan, which on both sides is just full of fallacies, but this polemic absolute dichotomy is created between the two sides. And, you know, people either have always been in support of Alex or people who are just emotionally enraged by the sort of atrocities that have happened throughout the past year with gun violence. Unfortunately, we aren't hearing much of the actual rational debate in between of the actual statistics of violent crime, of, you know, gun-related deaths, both in America and other comparable countries. So I think it's important to try to use logic and reason and first identify the fallacies associated, for example, with Piers Morgan and Alex Jones, and then to try to go deeper into the actual empirical evidence to see what we can actually draw conclusions on that are going to help us make fundamental and, you know, constructive changes moving forward.
Yeah, when you're saying that, I'm thinking back to watching this with my face in my hands the other day, this interview with Alex Jones on Piers Morgan. Piers Morgan strikes me as somebody who would be so easy to defeat in a calm and peaceful way. Many of you might have also watched his interactions with gun freedom advocates prior to the Alex Jones interview the other night, and he was completely hysterical. It was fallacy after fallacy, relying most heavily on ad hominem. If a person posed a question that he could not answer or issued a coherent response to one of his questions, and he just appears to be this robot who keeps lobbing these questions at these people and not really giving them any kind of thoughtful response. It doesn't really seem like Piers Morgan is interested in having a conversation. He just wants to keep throwing these questions and hoping that one or two things stick. It was very easy, especially with Larry Pratt, who is the head of Gun Owners Association of America, that Piers Morgan would become very, very frustrated when Pratt could answer his questions. This is something that I've encountered in a lot of, you know, my political debates with people. It seems like the more information you have, the angrier they get. And I know this is kind of a Machiavellian approach, but what Alex Jones should have done if he wanted to win that debate, and this goes back to the emotional argumentation that you were speaking to, Tony, he should have put Piers Morgan on the offensive. He didn't even give Piers Morgan a chance to talk. He should have spent a couple minutes not giving him what he wants, and that would have made Piers Morgan into that emotional wreck. And I'm not saying that that's an honest debate, but if Alex Jones's goal was to go on and make a case for, you know, all of the things that Alex Jones claims to stand for, it really seems like he just went about it completely the wrong way.
Well, first of all, I'd like to just say that is extremely intelligent what you said about how Alex Jones sort of presented himself, first by actually asking questions. This is a strategy in litigation. Lawyers know this endlessly. Does this say, perhaps it's like this, or to present a sort of question instead of coming in with these sort of concrete absolute statements. And in doing so, what happens is you create a trap.
The question I wanted to ask you, Pierce, because I've seen you talk about assault weapons a lot, and I've seen Mark Kelly talk about assault weapons. Mm-hmm. The vast majority of murders in this country that are committed with guns are not committed with assault weapons, they're committed with handguns. Okay, so are you willing to ban handguns in this country across the country?
No, that's not what I'm asking for.
Why not?
Let me ask you.
Don't you care about the kids who are being killed in Chicago as much as the kids in Sandy Hook?
Yes, I do.
Then why don't you care about banning the handguns in Chicago?
No, we'll come to that. Let me ask you this.
And that's exactly what Piers Morgan did for Alex Jones. He asked specific questions that are actually straw men, that he's building up this straw man to tear it down to make all of Alex's points seem absolutely ridiculous. But in fact, all those points have absolutely nothing to do with violent crime, gun crime, and what exactly is going on in America and the rest of the world as far as actually how violent crime works and what the statistics actually are and how it affects us as individuals. So it is very interesting because you are, in fact, 100%. I couldn't agree more. Obviously, the debate wasn't really much of a debate. Now, in classical debate and even in medieval argumentation going back to, for the 13th century, in medieval argumentation, in order to avoid, for example, non sequiturs, arguments that do not follow from the beginning proposition, in order to avoid that, you had to define your terms up front. So, and the way they did this, the way they got over this in debate was each person had to state their idea, and then they had to restate each person's idea in their own words. And that way they at least got kind of on a common ground to see, make sure they weren't going to follow through with something that didn't make any sense. And so it's very interesting that we see this sort of dumbing down of the debate, if you will, because I mean, that's what I noticed. And Alex Jones, you know, he has a very interesting disposition in general. His show, if you've watched him for the past 16, 17 years, he really hasn't changed much in the way he acts on his show, the way he gets people revved up. And, you know, that's just something part of his culture, I believe, down in Texas and just that old value system he's kind of grew up with. I don't know Alex Jones personally. And quite honestly, you know, I find myself agreeing with a lot of the facts that he and his, you know, co-hosts present. However, what I find very troubling, and much to what you just said earlier on, he seems to present himself as this sort of leader. And a lot of people really fall in line with that sort of like, we need someone else to give us the answer. But with libertarian values, it's really about us giving ourselves our own answer, using our own reasoning abilities and coming using our own five senses and experiencing life and coming to our own conclusions. And, you know, I think that's in stark contrast to the way he's kind of built up his operation over the years. I don't think it's in a direct, and this is a bit of speculation, I don't think it's directly something he's intentionally necessarily doing, but it's probably a product of what happens after you build up your own company for 15, 16, 17 years. You tend to surround yourself with people who think like you do and act like you do sometimes, although sure. I have to admit he's done a very good job at surrounding himself with much more calm and cool and collected people, but he still obviously holds himself as a sort of the one who runs the entire operation, the figurehead. You know, he points himself, and that's what makes it very, first of all, to call it a debate, that's difficult in itself. But then when you hear what happens after the debate on both sides, you know, it's hard to take either side very seriously. On one side, it's, you know, the threats against he and his family, which, again, we can get into the fallacy of hyperbole, and that's a fallacy of language, but tending to emotionally exacerbate the situation with just a couple of snide and crude remarks that were, I believe, made the day after on CNN, which were uncalled for. And quite frankly, yes, he has a legitimate concern. However, if they really meant it in the sort of context they did, you know, that's very difficult to say. But on the other side, you know, obviously Piers Morgan is the classic definition of a sophist.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
He uses logic and rhetoric to his advantage in order to perpetuate a certain agenda. And he is, and exactly because, you know, you pointed this out as well, he is very cool and collected. However, the way he does it, he just asks questions. Each one of those questions are traps because those questions, he's leading down to a certain agenda, a certain conclusion that he wants to fall into so he can come in with all this other data that makes him look very intelligent, that can, you know, stomp down Alex Jones. And it's very interesting because he's obviously at least somewhat trained in the ideas of how to kind of get people to trap themselves in argumentation, either with circular logic or, you know, non sequiturs or these sort of emotional attacks against the person or building up these fake points that have nothing to do with the actual argument and straw men and tearing it down. All of these are fallacies. And when you hear this as an individual, first thing you should do is just dismiss the point. Just listen to what's being said, not how it's being said, which is very difficult to remove yourself from that sort of emotional. Todd, like you said, you almost have to put your hands in your face. I know a couple times I had to pause it and just kind of catch my breath because it's just so emotionally grabbing. It's almost impossible immediately to remove yourself from that sort of emotional grab, whether it's just too much for you and you kind of have to move away from it completely, or just you kind of go along with one of the polemics. And that's very difficult to do. And it's very interesting to see the sort of different styles of argumentation. Because on one hand, you have someone who's trained, obviously, in sophistry. He's trying to perpetuate or push an agenda. And he's trying to get Alex, by building up straw men, he's trying to get Alex Jones to answer his questions and fall into his trap that he's, you know, cleverly laid out, in my opinion. It's very obvious what he's doing. But because of Alex Jones' whole disposition, his whole demeanor throughout the debate, I mean, who looks more rational in this case? I would like to ask every, you know, person who watched this, who has no emotional leaning one way or the other, who looks more rational throughout the debate. And obviously the one who's cool, calm, and collected is going to get through a little bit easier. And he knows this. Alex Jones, though, his entire career has been, he's had this sort of, you know, gung-ho personality, you know, his sort of all action and, you know, the thinking comes afterwards. But that's not necessarily true of his operation in general. I've watched Alex Jones over the past couple of years off and on. And, you know, he's very much human, it seems like. But at the same token, he does like to present himself as a leader of this sort of libertarian movement. And that is in itself a sort of fallacy, or at least it's an oxymoronic statement to say you're a leader of libertarian values, which are really about individual freedom, you know, individual freedoms that we come to through our own experiences in life. He's not the one holding your hand through it. So.
Well, sure. Let's go back to Piers Morgan and what you were saying there for a minute. It almost seemed like, and this is what I said to you earlier in the day, like Piers Morgan's producers or whoever's handling him used this to offset Morgan's prior freakouts, prior just really embarrassing presentations directed at people in these debates over the last couple months, almost to say, like, well, if you think Piers is an emotional wreck, wait till you see the true colors of the other side channeled through Alex Jones. Now, on Alex Jones, yeah, I think that there are a couple factors that you're talking about, the culture that might be specific to a place. You know, the United States is a big place, and if you stuck it anywhere else in the world, it would cover like 30 countries. So it is true that, you know, if you live up north in Connecticut or Rhode Island or New Hampshire, you know, Texas might be a very different culture. There might be more, or it might be more common that there's that kind of bravado. But I think that there's also the important question of, like, where does it come from? So in my quest to find this human moment in Alex Jones, I stumbled across this monologue that he was giving just the other day, and he talked about being bullied.
And all I ever wanted was freedom. Nothing more. All I ever wanted was decency and honor. Yes, I have a temper about bullies. It's a hot button. Bullies really get me upset. And it's probably because I got beat up. No exaggeration, probably 50-something times by bullies before I learned to fight back. And now it's just instinctive. I get really upset. And that's why I blow up. Is because I'm not good at running. And I knew these were police in New York, and I had to swallow my pride. A few times I almost got in their faces, and I thought, no, that's what they want. So I got out of there.
And, you know, he said, I just can't. The reason why I get so upset, folks, is I just can't back down from a bully. And I thought, well, that's, you know, particularly tragic where somebody has this huge platform and in many cases is sharing a lot of really valuable information. And yes, it just seems like, as far as like the mainstream perception is concerned, that any of that true information that people should know, that people could benefit from, which is maybe a majority of what is being presented on Alex Jones each day, filtered through the hysteria of Alex Jones, it becomes immediately dismissible. And that's really, really tragic. And, you know, part of me watching this video of Alex Jones today, giving him the benefit of the doubt, just makes me kind of want to give him a hug. But, you know, on the other hand, too, to say, gosh, you know, I really, really wish you could just calm down, because if he and his team, which he has, you know, which, and another thing that you spoke to, it's probably pretty insular. There probably are quite a few yes men at Infowars.com saying, oh yeah, Alex, that's great. But if he had just watched these debates and sat there patiently, he could have given Piers Morgan, the rope to hang himself, with. He had this, Larry Pratt, the Gun Owners Association guy, on the next day. Piers Morgan makes a blatantly circular argument. Larry Pratt points it out that it is a circular argument. Piers Morgan immediately shifts directions and makes an appeal to authority, saying, well, General McChrystal doesn't like these assault weapons, and he's a military general, without even addressing the claim that this is a circular argument. I think what he said is, no, it's not a circular argument. It's a fact.
It's really interesting you say that, because that's a complete misdirect, or a redirect in this case. Very interesting, because that really is sophisticated training. And like you said before, he has these freak out moments. He has a sort of dubious past, if you will, with what he did over in England, sure, in his editorial career, which I won't get into right now. But he has a sort of interesting past that, you know, as an individual, it's worth looking up and seeing who might this man be. You know, let's look up who this is. But that's clever that he would do that sort of misdirect or redirect. And the reason why it is clever is because if you do it very quickly, people won't have time to consciously kind of in their own brains filter it quick enough. And all of a sudden you're listening to the next point without realizing, oh, what just happened? He redirected the circular argument. And, you know, that's something that happens all the time and quick. That's why, you know, with Alex Jones, watching that debate, you know, I got kind of revved up with Piers Morgan and Alex Jones. But after, you know, I calmed down and I thought about it, I was able to really sift through the different fallacies and the problems with both sides of this, if you want to even call it a debate. And it's very clever to see that he would redirect like that instantly, you know, without becoming a little bit wayward in his own approach. He instantly redirected it to this sort of completely different point. And that's a very clever, sophisticated technique where you just don't have time to, you know, cognize that something's happened, and the viewer immediately listens to the new points being raised. And, you know, the conscious filter doesn't have time to remove it altogether, what just happened.
Yeah, that's
clever.
I want to be clear, too, that we're talking about Piers Morgan here. And some of the things that I've said might sound like I approach trying to share information with other people in kind of a cold and calculating, I use the word Machiavellian, way. I certainly don't recommend this in, you know, one-on-one interpersonal interactions with ordinary people. But I think what you're speaking to, Tony, is Piers Morgan is not that. Alex Jones referred to him as a hatchet man. There isn't really much evidence that he is anything more than that. He certainly isn't presenting a coherent, impassioned argument against nonviolence that is consistent, because all he's talking about is citizens with guns. He's not speaking out against the violence being carried out by his own government or the United States government that he seems to support so much on this issue in other countries. So there is really no evidence of consistency as far as being nonviolent or striving for a nonviolent society. He immediately bats away any evidence or statistics about the amount of violence that goes on in the UK. He had no interest in his discussion with Larry Pratt about talking about Fast and Furious and the murders that resulted from that policy of the Obama administration. So he is laser focused on this issue, and that certainly does raise a lot of suspicion about what his true agenda is, and his past is certainly very questionable. He could have
I believe it was the Daily Mirror, if I'm correct, where he had accusations against him, and I don't know if those actually followed through. I do know he was, you know, he had a committee question him on the sort of legalities of what happened, him being the editor there, and the potential, I believe it was phone hacking, that could have potentially went on. And if we know anything, there's a great documentary called Star Suckers. Mm-hmm. And not to get too off point here, the one point about this documentary, it's made by it's made by people who live in Britain. It's very interesting because it shows a sort of case study of a media culture and what the impact has on our behaviors as individuals. And the tabloid culture and that whole editorial culture, from the newspapers to the tabloids to, you know, everything, is very different from America, but very much the same, just much more brutal. they're much more open about their sort of willingness to disregard laws. And that this is something that's kind of a truism of European and especially British tabloids and newspapers. I think it's a bit more hush-hush over here just because of how systematic things seem to be here. But that it's a sort of different situation, but nonetheless, there are similarities. But if you watch Starsuckers, you'll see a sort of very interesting picture being painted from a very... very well researched and factually oriented presentation of exactly what effects this sort of media culture is having on our own beliefs and the sort of feedback loops we developed with our television sets and our phones and our computers, and how we sort of idealize, you know, people and who create these sort of, you know, different news and media entertainments and whatnot. So it's very interesting to see.
Yeah, it's an interesting point. Well, it's also worth pointing out on that note that, you know, Alex Jones in many ways might be a product of that media culture because he's been so absolutely critical of the corporate media and the globalist controlled media, the New World Order controlled cable news stations. But he's using a lot of the same tactics on his show day in and day out as far as the ad hominem attacks, a myriad of other fallacies that he employs frequently, that it seems like if he does really understand the rules of logic and the rules of, or really like the decency and respect for others, the intelligence of others when it comes to rhetoric, he is really cutting a lot of corners and trying to get away with a lot of the same tricks. I think that listening to his show, although it is a very different explicit message than what you will get from the mainstream media, that message is still very consistent. And it's a message of resignation and smallness, the smallness that you should feel as a listener to the Alex Jones show, because them, the NWO, the globalists, are just too powerful. Now, this message is occasionally punctuated by some empty, seemingly inspirational rhetoric about protecting your family or fortifying your home or buying filtered water. I don't want to diminish Alex Jones. I don't want to label him as some kind of shill. I just think that, you know, who he is and from what I've observed, his lack of personal freedom, just being so weighed down by fear and anger and this blame has really hurt his ability to craft a positive, effectual, actionable message for people.
The rhetorical vehicle he uses, unfortunately, has caused him a lot more stress and anxiety over the years instead of a sort of constructive growth. And, you know, on one way we could say, well, things have become so seemingly chaotic in our own, not only in our own personal lives, but obviously what's happened just in the year of 2012 itself, with, you know, Coney, for example, but then also the myriad amount of shootings that's happened. I can see why he can get so floored and, you know, excited. I'd like to go back to some of the points you made earlier when you said, in a way, he presents this sort of dichotomy, which might be a reflection of his own emotional disposition, I'm unsure, and I can't really make a statement that way or not. But he does really create this sort of dichotomy. You're either with us or you're against us. And these sort of absolute statements, you know, I'm not really trying to compare him to any sort of great dictator in history, but the point being made is whenever you make an either or fallacy, whenever you make these sort of absolute statements, you can fall into those camps and you end up all of a sudden trying to justify that either or, whichever camp or polemic you decide to fall into, almost unconsciously, just because it goes back to our sort of animal loyalty behaviors that we developed and, you know, probably evolved here over time, I would imagine. But that's just a sort of speculation on anthropology. Either way, whenever you do that, you end up falling into a group and a group think we hear often, or collectivism and these sorts of things. And you can kind of see almost unconsciously how people can start just trying to justify. It happens naturally with us just as individuals, whether it's our own health or whether it's just something we're going through in our own lives. We like to try to justify our own behaviors and come up with these sort of many times fallacious logical arguments in our head to justify why we do something, when in fact we know it's not necessarily beneficial for us. And now if you extrapolate that to a large, you know, concern, you can take it from a personal experience to, and then you all of a sudden you can see it on a macro level, exactly what's happening, how a lot of times we're just going along with the yes men instead of really truly trying to remove ourselves, especially emotionally, from a lot of these sort of rhetorical vehicles that he gets caught up in. Now, his whole show has been kind of surrounded by that. And I have to admit, I really do, watching the show over especially the past 2 years on and off, especially helping out with Tragedy and Hope, we'd use some of his material just looking for very specific factual points, which I have to say, he's on point with a lot of the facts he brings up.
Sure.
And he has a great platform for being able to showcase those with all the different cameras and the new studio he has. However, I could not agree more with his sort of rhetorical vehicle, which is very aggressive. He almost argues, he has this sort of ad verecundium fallacy he employs with this argument from authority. But he being the authority, or this sort of like general collective of freedom, you know, is as the authority, or an ad baculum that we need to almost attack them, or obviously the ad hominem, you know, attacking these people and what they stand for. So it's very interesting, all these different fallacies that he employs, and it's always very aggressive. It always has a sort of aggression behind it and this sort of angst behind it. The big question to ask is, is it a show? Is he putting on this, like I mentioned before, Star Suckers? Is he putting on a show to water down the actual facts he's presenting? Which quite often, you know, when it comes to snake oil salesmen, what they do is they'll tell you 99% facts and then they leave that 1% out that you don't know about. And that's really where the whole argument falls apart.
Right.
If anything, unfortunately, his facts are so on point that he belittles, it seemingly, the general message of individual freedom, because of his own rhetorical vehicle of anger and his own fallacies that are associated with that rhetorical vehicle. Like I mentioned, verecundium, baculum, ad hominem.
Well, he
contradicts it. The dichotomy fallacy.
He actually contradicts it, in my opinion, because, I mean, this shows us, like what you're saying, presentation, it's not everything, but it's really important. And Glenn Beck was talking about it with his crew on his radio show, and he said something. He echoed a sentiment that I've heard from you, that I've heard from Richard Grove when talking about Alex Jones before. The quote from Glenn Beck was, "These sound like the ravings of a fascist." And if you look at his speech, if you look at a lot of his rhetoric, the very fallacies that you are describing, but combined with his gestures, combined with his body language, especially on Piers Morgan, a lot of people will walk away from the Alex Jones presentation just from seeing, maybe if Piers Morgan is their only exposure, or maybe like the Alex Jones highlight reel of his greatest rants on YouTube, that freedom equals threat. And the Piers Morgan show could not have been scripted better when they kick him off after two segments and they bring in famous lawyer Alan Dershowitz for segment three, who, as a lawyer, enters Alex Jones as Exhibit A in the argument for the disarmament of the American public. It was beautifully scripted, in my opinion, on the Piers Morgan producers or on CNN's part or whoever's behind it. I don't want to speculate.
But however, sorry to cut you off here, but that's a legitimate hypothesis, because you're bringing up specific instances and showing like there might have been a pretty consistent agenda here, because obviously it moved exactly the way Piers Morgan wanted it to move. And he did showcase, you know, obviously, this is not, unfortunately, this is not Alex Jones' first time doing this. I mean, there's been examples where he's been on, for example, The View, where he did very much the same thing. He comes on very aggressive and just tries to get so many points in there that he allows no one else to talk. And then it's really not a debate. It's just him sounding sort of emotionally crazed.
Sure.
And that obviously shuts people off from the actual, because even listening to the Piers Morgan debate, there's a lot of facts. Legitimate facts, in fact, that Alex Jones is bringing up. And he's actually getting to more causal foundations or perspectives on what's really going on behind this sort of violent crime that's happening in America, especially the school shootings that have happened, or, you know, the Aurora, Colorado shooting that happened in the movie theater. So it's interesting to look at it that in that perspective, and the way he acts when he does get on mainstream media.
Tell me why I'm wrong.
Why don't you want to get rid of the drugs? Because they're half your sponsors?
Stick to the subject.
America's number one cause of unnatural death now is suicide.
Okay. Alex,
not automobile accident, not cancer, not...
You accuse me of attacking the Second Amendment of the Constitution.
I want to get people off pills that the insert says will make you commit suicide and kill people.
Alex, let's get about to the Second Amendment.
I want to blame the real culprit.
Alex.
Suicide pills.
Alex.
Mass murder pills.
Okay, let me ask you one question. You'll believe, unless I'm wrong.
First time anybody's ever heard this, by the way.
Now, the question is he acting that way because that's just the way he is? And when he finally gets the opportunity, he wants to go on there and be like, I'm going to cram every point I can in because it's the only opportunity I'm going to get, and I might not get one again. Or is he just doing this to fall into their trap willingly, nesciently? Is he ignorant to the fact? I don't know. But we do have to say our minds work associationally. Our minds will associate, especially these emotional tirades, to him being. So when they have Dershowitz come on and say, you know, obviously this is a crazed man, this is why we need to get rid of guns. Well, our minds are associating his, you know, that pseudo debate that happened, and we're associating immediately to this like sort of logical conclusion from this lawyer that obviously he's insane. And this is the quintessence of sophistry. And this is a perfect example for individuals looking to refine their own logical skills to understand this is a perfect setup for it. Whether or not it happened serendipitously or if this was more or less planned, I think there's at least cause for a hypothesis here to say there's a certain agenda behind Piers Morgan.
Sure. Yeah. And I think at this point in Alex Jones's career, he should know better. And his defense
Absolutely. And
his defenders will say, well, the approach when Alex goes on these shows where he knows the format is very controlled, that he is there kind of to be made the fool, is to throw out as much factual information as possible in the time allocated and have people go research it on their own, maybe just to spark somebody's interest in a certain topic. But Alex Jones should also know when he talks about most people, you know, in this very derisive and dismissive way of people being sheep and people just being led around by the mainstream media, that when he says the phrase New World Order, which is a very real concept that's been talked about by a lot of powerful people in politics and the media. We have the book by H.G. Wells, you know, talking about the need for bringing the world under the control of one government. Like, it's all a real concept, but most people have never...
The open conspiracy.
Most people have never heard that before. So in 30 seconds of talking and spitting all over this seemingly very polite and composed British gentleman, he says, New World Order, Building 7. You know, it's sad for us to say that, you know, acknowledge this, but most people have never heard of Building 7. They don't know what that's a reference to. So Alex Jones does, as you're saying, just come away looking like a raving madman.
It's posted right now, Infowars.com.
Who do you believe was behind 9/11?
Oh, I absolutely know. I have the police on CNN saying, get back, they're going to blow up 7. I have BBC reporting.
Who do you believe is behind
I have the proof. I heard them on CBS radio.
Who, Alex?
They announced they blew up the towers on CBS radio.
Who do you believe?
New Yorkers all saw it and heard it.
Alex, who do you
believe? They blew up Building 7.
Alex, who do you believe was behind it? The American government?
Criminal elements of the military-industrial complex, the same ones that staged Gulf of Tonkin, the same ones that staged Operation, the mass shootings of Operation Gladio.
Right.
Ooh, the CIA don't like this right now.
Do you mean that President Bush and his administration were behind 9/11?
I mean that even mainstream news reported that the hijackers were ordered to be allowed into the United States. Michael Springman, the head of the Visa Department, blew the whistle on that.
So the Bush administration was part of a conspiracy.
Well, he should never let us tolerate
to murder Americans.
I can speak in this accent as well.
Yeah.
The
but is that
government,
what you believe?
Hitler firebombed his own Reichstag, Pierce. Mm.
Well, the 9/11 thing was a very clever misdirect because obviously at the very end when he presents this, what are your feelings on 9/11? Do you believe the government did it? And obviously, you know, he comes in and says these sorts of like it's aspects of the military industrial complex. But obviously, the reason why Piers Morgan does that is exactly what you just said, Brett. Most people have no idea what happened really around 9/11. It's shocking. To me and to other individuals who have really researched into exactly what's happened with 9/11. But no one really knows about Building 7. No one knows about the wayward missing financial transactions. No one knows about, you know, what was contained within Building 7, the information. And that those are all tertiary points right now. Because I don't know what's happened in specific. But I will say the fact that Piers Morgan brings up 9/11 is to specifically show Alex Jones as being crazy.
Right.
It's a very, very clever, especially the way Alex Jones acted the entire way. That's all he had to do at the end. I mean, Alex Jones was just so emotional. And just so, even though the points he continually brought up, I'm like, those are good points about the SSRIs and about, you know, the drug in America, the whole psychology department. Now, this is something I know you know, having experience in the school system, especially with how pharmaceutical companies interact with schools and, you know, all this whole sort of scratching each other's back that goes on, to employ cliche. But it's very interesting because there are, you know, I say in the whole argument, there's this dismissal of actual cause and effect. It's a fallacy of argumentation. It's an informal fallacy in this case, but they're confusing cause and effect. In this case, they're saying the gun itself is the cause, but they're not even getting into more potentially causal factors of what would cause these sorts of behaviors in human beings. And so some of the points that Alex does try to bring up are actually probably legitimate. And he could have, if he knew how to rhetorically present himself in his own disposition could have been made to be very powerful, and it could have been able to get through to people to people who have never considered those points, especially when Piers Morgan is trying just to bring up the fact that what happened in the past year has been, you know, these semi-automatic weapons, specifically the AR-15, you know, which was used in these two specific shootings. If I believe I'm correct on that one, I believe it was the AR-15, mm-hmm. both in the Aurora, Colorado massacre and the Newton massacre. If in fact, like, he keeps bringing it back to just these guns, and we need to focus just on these sorts of issues, when in fact there's so many statistics and so many things we need to first of all focus on, you know, violent crime rate, the murder rate by guns, where most of murder is taking place. So there's a level of granularity that if you don't look at, you can come to these very, it's a fallacy of overgeneralization, right?
Yeah.
That's this gross overgeneralization on exactly, which creates these sort of emotional polemics, exactly what we see with Piers Morgan and Alex Jones. And this dichotomy is almost perfect because you and I both have obviously, we've done some research into the Hegel and that famous dialectic attributed to him, but really to Francis Bacon. And it's really more of a philosophical thought. But in this case, you're setting up these two polemics to create the third perfect solution, right? You're creating this problem. The problem is, you know, there's screaming guns or the individual or whatever it be. And then obviously they want a reaction. The reaction is, and we see from from Vice President Joe Biden, what's the reaction? They're considering now an executive order, an executive order that could potentially override the Second Amendment. But the Second Amendment, the Bill Rights was essentially created to protect individual freedoms from tyranny,
right?
From tyranny, and that's the Second Amendment specifically. It's supposed to protect and give individuals the right to have firearms to protect themselves against tyranny, to rise up against, you know, militias or armies or whatever it be over time. And that's, it's not about hunting, really, is not. You know, when the founding fathers decided to, you know, create this amendment to the Constitution, this is one of the specific things they're thinking of, but obviously for the reasons of what just happened in the past couple decades.
Yeah.
Obviously with the revolution. So it's fresh in their mind is the idea that their property, not only themselves is their own property, but the property they own and their family they're trying to protect. The only way they can do it is essentially by having at least some measure of power in the form of a way to protect themselves with comparable technology. And Carol Quigley specifically talks about this in 1880, as far as well as the only other comparable correlation in history, I believe, is the 5th century BC in Greece, where the citizenry essentially had a very similar arms to the government. And so what happened was that's really when the most freedom, at least from a contextual historical perspective, actually existed for individual citizens. Because all of a sudden, from the level of technology, just because of the way technology had advanced in those two specific periods, the government, the collective versus the individual people had very similar ability to defend themselves or attack someone. And so that's a very interesting perspective that quite honestly is never brought up. Obviously, the 20th century has completely changed the game on that argument, but it is at least worth noting, the sort of going into the sort of contextual history to give an idea of what that actually means for being able to defend our own property, including ourselves.
And I think
because we are our property.
And I think it's such a confronting question. I mean, I kept when I watch these kind of interviews, I just keep fantasizing about, you know, subtracting one of these people on the other side of the table and putting me in their place, cool, calm, and collected in the moment, and really trying to raise some important questions that I think could be very confronting. Like, do you think, like, yes, of course, we all go to these government schools where we learn about how we live under the most righteous and just and liberty-oriented government the world has ever seen. Sure, of course the government would teach us that, but do you believe, and I'm asking you, Piers Morgan, or who's ever on the other side of the table, do you believe that we are somehow, even if that is true, and it's fine if you believe that, but do you think we are frozen in time at that moment? That, you know, this period of freedom that you're talking about, or this period in American history that is always so romanticized by conservatives and constitutionalists and even libertarians. Like, don't you think that would just be such a simple question to ask? Because it is, in mainstream thought, it is such a dismissible, ridiculous sounding idea that we need to arm up to protect ourselves from a tyrannical government. That does not resonate with people because the move from freedom to fascism, or whatever you want to call it, however you want to characterize it, has been too slow. It hasn't been palpable enough for people to recognize the change. And I think that people also, from my experience anyway, are pretty adept at just integrating whatever the new step is into their thinking as, well, this is where we are now. And in my more cynical moments, I think, you know, if they were loading people like Alex Jones tomorrow onto a train, you know, to bring him to some kind of re-education camp, there would be a lot of people that would say, you know what, that's probably what's best for Alex Jones. And I think that's a legitimate point though. This just really took a huge step in the wrong direction. I was talking to Osborne on the phone the other night, my co-host for the live show, and I said this interview on Piers Morgan was like the 9/11 of personal self-defense. This was so the wrong thing to happen at this time. And one of the things that was most troubling for me is just this idea that we keep coming back to. Alex Jones, with 17, 18 years of experience and studying this and all of the real information, the context that he has, should have known better. And the fact that he didn't, you know, I guess that might be more of a personal thing, that I do hope that Alex Jones will look at and figure out how to present himself better, more rationally, more calmly. But it's also troubling in the sense, like, what was the purpose of what we saw the other night? And I know there's a little bit of maybe paranoia there on my part, but I think that this is an important discussion to be having for people who, you know, claim to be liberty oriented after this man, you know, goes on that tirade and then a day later declares himself the leader of all things associated with liberty.
I just have to go back to when you said that sort of palpability, this sort of the tangible, sensible perspective, that people are so far removed from that sort of cause and effect of needing to own a sort of, or needing to have any sort of self-defense, from a sort of martial arts training to owning a gun or having any training in any way, both either to defend yourself or to hunt or to provide your own, you know, subsistence. What's interesting is, like, obviously when you study the history of psychology, one of the great things is obviously William James's magnum opus of the principles of psychology talks about habit. And of course, if anyone's had the chance to go over Tragedy and Hope and view the Ultimate History Lesson, where we interview John Taylor Gatto, it's a 5-hour interview, but I believe in the third hour, he goes into, it's either the third or fourth hour, he goes into these different aspects of the history of psychology. And one of the things they found out is, what happens when you move the sort of cause and effect, that sort of like the feeling of a personal nature to something that's happening, and what the effect this has on human beings. And, you know, obviously there's been plenty of experiments to show these different effects. One of them was famous in New York, where there's, you know, the classic one we always hear of someone in a massive city like New York, you walk by them and they're getting beat up by some thugs in a corner or in an alley. And because you don't feel personally responsible, because you're not personally part of that situation, we tend to go about our daily business and act like that's not something I need to deal with. There's an authority, obviously, that comes in, we'll deal with that. But the second that the person who's being accosted makes some innocent bystander say, "You help me," that sort of personal interaction completely changes the disposition of our behaviors. 100%. And this has been studied many times over. And it's very interesting to note that on a very massive scale, and I'll extrapolate this to a very massive scale, what happens when you actually remove cause and effect? This goes directly with logic, because in the law of identity. And so when you remove cause and effect, essentially people have nowhere to turn to actually find ways to start from the first principles to make actual constructive change at all. And so this is, you know, from a psychological standpoint, obviously the cause and effect so far removed now, from us needing to feel like we need to have our own ways of defending ourselves, both mentally and or physically. And that's really important, because all of a sudden, what do? In the absence of that, we turn to an authority. We turn to a third party to give us that sort of answer. And obviously, those third parties over time become so corrupt, because the cause and effect's been so far removed, there's essentially no integrity behind the system that's being created, because there's no watchdog, there's no oversight of it. By concerned individuals. And so, you know, it's a very interesting effect of just behaviorism, and, you know, essentially what happened throughout the 20th century. Because it's another word to point out is this sort of incremental removal of, you know, our individual rights. It's very interesting to note that, you know, the UN has this declaration that was in 1961 about this disarming world's the citizens essentially of all these different countries. Mm-hmm. And why the UN would be demanding policy in 1961 for national governments, very interesting. Now, what do we see? A continual movement. And if we go back to the Ultimate History Lesson, there is a famous little quote that statement that John Gatto made, where he essentially said this argument between two famous eugenicists, Beatrice Webb and Herbert Spencer. Right. And Herbert Spencer, you know, kill the brutes, kill them all, you know, set up camps and try to do what the Nazis did, or Beatrice Webb, Fabian socialist, obviously the wolf in sheep's clothing. incremental stages of eugenics, you know, introduce these sort of like socialistic tendencies, sort of collectivistic tendencies, and root out the ill, whatever that be, of society by incremental steps, and may, you know, kill them with kindness, right? I think that's a very important consideration. All of those are very important considerations. We look at the overall machinations of what we see as just a retardation or a elimination of our own individual rights. Where is it coming from? Why is policy being now demanded on an international level? Although, you know, people don't give much credence or belief to the power of the UN, there's definitely an incremental sort of movement towards, obviously, our own individual rights being removed. So I think it's something to look at and something to consider insofar as at least forming a somewhat valid hypothesis.
Sure, and I think that shows. And I don't want to insult anybody, but a lot of this talk gets a lot of eye rolls. And I think the idea, just if you look at the trends of history and the consolidation of power and the advantages for the very few of consolidating power, the idea that it's even remotely controversial that such plans would exist says to me that a lot of people, I think, you know, just a recommendation on my part, need to take a closer look at this stuff. I'm kind of afraid to say a phrase like Agenda 21 on my show. Like, I'm kind of apprehensive about that. It gives me just a couple ants in my pants, right? Because you know the perception. And this is something that I feel like I'm really in tune to when other people do it. Like when Alex Jones says, like, I've talked with you about this, I think, before, and certainly with others as well. Alex Jones will put together a 25-minute dialogue that is really coherent, that contains a lot of valuable information, and then he will just blow it in the last 30 seconds by saying the craziest thing. I think I said there was some video, it was around the time of the Aurora shooting, I was watching, I was getting it ready, getting the URL ready to send to ordinary folks on my email contact list. And then in the last 2 or 3 minutes, he just made it something that was unfortunately unusable. And, I understand the apprehension to discuss some of these things, at least in my circles. Go ahead.
Yeah, no, I'm sorry, but you just raised such a good point, because there is a sort of apprehension. I even had an apprehension myself, helping to film the Ultimate History Lesson with Richard Grove and Lisa over at Tragedy and Hope, and obviously Kevin Cole as well, which are kind of the team we did to come together to film him. But this sort of apprehension, even to coming into the sort of this knowledge, like, it's very easy, I think, to fall into the trap to think there's this other group. There's this one specific other group that's 100% against everyone and everything, all that's good in the human condition. You know, that's why I kind of find Stefan Molyneux's work a little bit interesting, as far as like the sort of personal nature and the way we treat ourselves and the way we treat our young people in society. And there's a sort of pattern here from the individual standpoint that really extrapolates the larger movement towards collectivism on any scale. And when you look at, you know, the history of these movements towards these sort of tyrannical and collectivistic states, it's always a progression. It's always a very slow progression with big events happening every once in a while. But if it was a very fast progression, the cause and effect would be too literal. People would be able to pinpoint exactly what's going on too quickly. And obviously that has happened in the past, which is why dictators have learned different ways to kind of really control, you know, put a jar over the fleas and, you know, kind of condition behaviors to make sure that they create this, you know, perfect society, whatever it be. I mean, a whole perfect society, or this whole idea of utopian societies, is something that's been discussed about most ancient philosophy and even medieval philosophy and even Enlightenment philosophy a bit with rationalism. It's just hashed in different language for the times, right? Mm-hmm. And different cultural values of the different areas of the world where these ideas are being espoused. So it's very interesting, because we can say, well, it's too overarching to believe there's this sort of movement. But obviously, some of the greatest philosophers of history have talked about it. I mean, Plato is the most famous, I believe, Francis Bacon, for example. In the 15th century, 15th, 16th century, if I'm not butchering that too badly, he talked about these sorts of utopian ideals as well. And so it's very important to consider these, that famous philosophers have always thought about how to design the perfect system. The 20th century is just representation was still from rationalism, this incremental movement using technology to create the sort of perfect system. And we see sometimes manifested in ideologies such as the Zeitgeist movement, which I don't know anything about anymore, because I've been so far removed from. But, you know, you see this sort of pattern where they say they're 100% against this governments of the world and everything, but you see the way technology is moving and the way everything's moving, it's sort of like to this this world control through technology. And who under whose control, I don't know. And I don't really believe it's a separate group. It's more philosophy. It's a way we're kind of doing it to ourselves without recognizing, like, look, there is a pattern in history. It seems to be something that maybe is embedded with our own behaviors and is very easily manipulable. And it really comes to the power of human belief and these sort of ideologies that can be built up.
Yeah, you mentioned Stefan Molyneux. One of the questions, he was actually my last guest. I didn't really have time to get into this with the depth I was hoping to, but we were talking about this, what we called the red pill blues, when people first understand these ideas. And I remember my apprehension listening to Wes Bertrand's Complete Liberty book and then listening to Free Domain Radio and saying, oh shit, am I some kind of an anarchist now? Like, you know, where do I go from here? But, you know, one of the questions I want to ask him is, like, initially people, when they start to understand these things, they go into political action. They see that that's the way they were always told that things were changed, is through the state, through the authority structure that existed. So they seem to gravitate to that. And, you know, one of the things I wanted to get into with Steph is the attraction to politics, because it's such an appropriate outlet for the emotions that people feel when they realize these things, the anger, the fear, the resentment, the betrayal. I mean, politics is just, that's what it seems to be all about. And the more I look at the political dialogue in this country or around the world, to go back to what you were talking about, it seems to be, on a massive scale, all of the most troubling and unfortunate things that go on inside the individual. You know what I mean?
So, oh, absolutely.
So the idea that this is not a group of people with mustaches and Monopoly hats meeting in a room on Jekyll Island, you know, yeah. this is more of...
It's much bigger than
that. And it's a philosophic corruption, which we've talked about before.
And that's, I think it's good to focus it from this point of ideologies and the point of ideas. It's really a philosophic corruption. And then they use these sort of sophisticated argumentations to create, essentially justify their position of why a collective is needed. You know, and it is interesting because I think it's something in us. Like, obviously, fear is one of the ubiquitous human emotions, and fear is addicting. And obviously, when it comes to libertarian values, we're talking about individual freedoms. A major constituent comes with that. And I think schooling, and we could go on endlessly about this, but schooling, ironically enough, because so much of our brain seems to be codified at a young age, we get used to the authority structure. And we always are looking for another authority, even if the authority is super logical, but another authority to latch onto, to give us that sort of like everything's going to be okay. But in fact, there's this great, when you really, you know, inundate yourself with these sort of libertarian values or these sort of just values of individual freedom, what's interesting there is self-responsibility seems to be a prerequisite of these sort of individual values and these individual freedoms. And self-responsibility is the first thing removed from us through the schooling and the parenting system currently in Western culture.
And this goes,
Yeah,
that goes all the way up to the top, though, too, because we know that it's common in conspiracies that a lot of these more secretive but very real groups, you know, the Fabian socialists, always seem to get wrapped up with these more mystical ideas. And there's all these conspiracies about the Illuminati and the Freemasons and the Merovingians. And it seems like instead of personal responsibility, instead of facing one's own personal, emotional, philosophical corruption or their megalomania or whatever it is that makes them hurt or incomplete inside, that they pursue these certainly morally objectionable goals, it seems very common that they try to find some kind of supernatural justification. Well, it's okay for me to rule the world because I have Merovingian blood, you know, or whatever. You know, I'm not sure I'm citing a real example, but that...
No, that's actually a great... Because you did a wonderful job in, you know, the three-part series that I believe you named the American Way,
yeah.
And you kind of relate how the Nazis themselves are extremely mystical, and, you know, mysticism, and there's many traditions of mysticism throughout the world, from the Orient to Western societies. Obviously, there's we could talk endlessly about all these different forms of mysticism, but the commonality, the generalization of mysticism, is a sort of direct experience with this sort of other, right? Well, the other in this case would be the authority. I don't know what direct experience. I mean, in this case, it's sort of assimilation of we're mystifying or apotheosizing the authority as an idea. And this authority, this overarching authority, is this ultimate idea, whether it be God or the state, that is going to control you and going to give you ascribe rights, the way you should act, the way you should be, the way, you know. And if you aren't that way, then you obviously are disposed of in some way, shape, or form. And It's very troubling to note that mysticism has this sort of like grandiose or this sort of apotheosizing of certain either ideals, people, or, you know, whatever, it could be whatever. But at the end of the day, what it does is sacrifice your own individual responsibility to use your percepts to form valid concepts. And those concepts hopefully can relate to as much of the physical world and your own experience as possible. So there isn't so much of a disconnect there. And we can be a little bit more sure in the judgments we make throughout our lives.
Mm. This is one of the reasons why I've been trying to promote Wes's work. I'm sure you're somewhat familiar with
wonderful job Wes does
with Complete Liberty, because he, since the very beginning, has been a very effective advocate for objectivist ideas, but has coupled it recently with this nonviolent communication approach. And finally, after decades of being complete dicks, you know, people who are sharing this rational philosophy, this counter to what was so much the direction of philosophy, especially in Central Europe throughout the 19th century, and much of the philosophy that we've inherited, as Ayn Rand pointed out, in America right up to the present day, objectivism, that counter to it, can finally be shared with people in a way that doesn't make them feel like idiots, which objectivists have just not been very good at since the 1970s.
Oh, I couldn't agree more. I like to go with the sort of Aristotelian approach of, I call it common sense, or the commonsensical approach, but not in the sort of way we use it as a euphemism throughout our lives. It's actually more in the way he meant it, is actually what we have in common with all of us, all humans have in common, is that we have five senses. And those five senses are used to perceive the world, which form these abstract concepts, which then we use to, for language, to communicate the experiences we have in the world. In a way, obviously, the objectivist school, there's a lot of history there. There's a lot of problems. But honestly, when they just get down to like Ayn Rand's lexicon, we just got down to the definition. She did a wonderful job of espousing these sort of like just very logical conclusions based on, you know, and trying to base it on the objective reality. I mean, we'd have to get into sort of the metaphysical problems of using logic. But one of the things I will point out of, you know, the 19th century and rationalism, two things that popped up during Darwinian, you know, and the whole Darwinian perspective, but then obviously symbolic logic. Those two things, chance is a part of Darwinian evolution. At the same time, we discover quantum physics, where everything just becomes statistical and probability theory. And then we took symbols and apply it for developing computer systems and applied all these different variables, and we called it symbolic logic. And logic kind of changed itself, because all of a sudden it's a mind first sort of perspective. You're defining the symbol.
Mm-hmm.
First, you're not allowing it to be just from a sort of commonsensical standpoint, and that's where we get into positivism, these sort of endless hypothetical scenarios, or empiricism, which is a little bit better, but not too much, because they tend to be a little bit solipsistic in their conclusions of not being able to really know or be conclusive about anything. And we get into some of these perversions throughout the 20th century of just philosophy in general. And without kind of getting back to a sort of grounding element, philosophy was really used, and logic itself, the Aristotelian approach to logic, was really just used to be on a common ground so people could actually communicate different ideas. And actually, you know, many kings and the court jesters and all these sorts of things, that they enjoyed this knowledge and this sort of ability to espouse these different ideas. You know, it's a very different perspective of what we're experiencing today in the 20th century versus what actually happened in history, and how logic was actually used to define all these other different philosophies. The 19th century in specific really represented a massive change in the way we thought, and that is really symbolized in the French Revolution. And then obviously, the American Revolution and the French Revolution, this sort of, they removed God from the situation, and they kind of put in this sort of rational idea of how to set up a government. And this, so they use this rationalistic mind first perspective of how to set up this perfect system. And there's many different systems based on, you know, these different ideals that were becoming realized at this time. But it's a very interesting sort of conundrum, because it doesn't look too much different if you actually analyze it over the course of 150 years from these utopian ideals of many of the different famous philosophers throughout history.
Right. Well, we've talked a lot, certainly on my show recently, about the box that everyone is in. And I know that's kind of a cliche, but when we look at the broader context and our philosophical inheritance, we do see, you know, going back to Alex Jones here, we do see that even though Alex Jones seems so different in so many meaningful ways, compared to what the acceptable public debate is, that as far as the collectivism, in many cases, the mysticism, the appeals to authority, he's kind of falling into a lot of the same traps, isn't he?
unfortunately, he does seem that he falls into the same traps, much like what I was just talking about with, you know, idealism and rationalism and kind of taking these ideas we develop in our mind and apotheosizing or making them godlike, these sort of authorities over everything else. And Alex Jones is kind of taking this idea of liberty, potentially taking this idea of liberty and then is coupling with that idea that he is this conduit for this idea of liberty. And through him, everything else falls into line. Well, that's still this sort of mystical authoritarian perspective. And, you know, I don't believe, and I don't know this for sure, this is speculation, I don't believe he's doing it necessarily consciously. I think it's something that develops out of this human behavior, especially when you build up the show that he's built up over the past 16, 17 years he's been doing it. And he, like I said, he presents some amazing facts. And he, most of the time, his fact-checking is obviously much better than most of the mainstream media. And the fact that they do talk about certain how the United Nations and these world structures are so directing policy in certain directions and using these incremental approaches, I'm glad that he's at least mentioning that. Obviously, in the mainstream news, you will never find mention of that at all. But it's just that, you know, just by our own human nature, I think we can kind of fall into these roles that we don't see ourselves developing into. But all of a sudden, instead of just being this free individual, he's now the leader of this sort of movement, this leader of this idea of liberty. Mm. But how do you become a leader of liberty? The only way you do that is through your own individual self and your own individual experiences throughout life. And, you know, to Alex Jones' credit, I do have to be fair here. Alex Jones, by himself, seemingly, built up this incredible production facility of the past 17 years. And that's a sort of mechanism. That's something to be proud of in his own right. I mean, to build up, to start your own business and to build up this sort of situation, especially with what he's doing and what he's talking about, is amazing in its own right. It's just the roles, I think, that we tend to fall into, and this behavioral conditions from schooling and then from parenting and just from all these effects of our experience throughout life. And I think it's important to just be a little bit more cognizant, especially being a free individual, of using just your own rational mind and just your own experiences throughout life. Try to come to your own judgment that will be advantageous to you and hopefully not won't be disadvantageous to you or your family. And that's really all logic's about. It's comparing and contrasting, and as best you can in the moment, making a judgment. And that judgment will either be advantageous or it won't be. And that obviously is an advantage is really a subjective quality, but not necessarily, because there are certain qualities that are ubiquitous to the entire human experience. And so, you know, it's interesting to see sort of how behaviorally we can fall into these sorts of roles. And I don't think Alex Jones is doing it with this intentional complex, if you will. I really don't necessarily see that, but he maybe now. But overall, his show does cover a lot of good things, but he really belittles the message. He belittles the facts so much by just his presentation style. One could say it's a cultural difference. Obviously, we're from the Northeast. In this case, you know, maybe it's a cultural difference in the way he was raised, and the way he acts, and the way he found to have effective rhetoric skills is through this sort of aggressive behavior. You know, he does appeal to a certain audience that respectfully he appeals to a certain audience. I don't like to use the word dumbed down, but is a product of this sort of culture and the institutions set up under the state.
Sure. And he is certainly, just on that note, he is real into these analogies or really metaphors about the Alamo and gunfighting, and uses the rhetoric like the Republic. It's a very Texas-y kind of presentation for sure. And that might be a cultural difference. I do want to second your compliment to Alex Jones. A good friend of yours and mine, George Bernard Shaw, did once say that, you know, your first duty to yourself in life is not to be poor. Of course, that because he wanted to euthanize you if you were. But, you know, I think that was one George Bernard Shaw quote that really resonated with me, because when you decide that you kind of want to carry this torch forward and you want to try and sustain yourself by presenting these ideas, you know, as I've tried to do through my show or through the work I've done in education to other people in a meaningful and usable way, you can't rest on your laurels of like, oh, I'm doing a good thing, if you can't pay your bills. And you're not really very useful to other people if you're always worried about your own financial insecurity, I've found too, you know, long term. I mean, certainly we go through rough times, but Alex Jones has created a business model that allows him to sustain himself and his family And, you know, if you take what he says at face value, he's able to present the material that he wants. He's able to attract sponsors that he believes in. You know, I mean, that's another subject, is like his 3-minute rants just leading into why you need to be a patron of this sponsor. But his business model has been a successful one, and that has created for him a platform where he can reach a great number of people. But also what you said, as far as the undermining of this message, it is particularly tragic. And it would be hard to explain to Alex Jones, I think, that this tragic expression of what's your story? Why are you so filled with, you know, paranoia and anger, at least on the surface, you know, that this isn't tragic because, you know, I'm making a lot of money and I've got this great studio and I'm reaching millions of people. But at what cost? You know, at what cost to him personally? I do sympathize with the stress he might feel by putting targets all over himself as he does, you know, assuming that he is a legitimate counterforce against the mainstream media. But the personal cost, and this goes back to the question of what does it mean to be the leader of a liberty movement? Because liberty is a personal thing, and it doesn't seem to me like he has a lot of personal liberty.
Yeah, I mean, I couldn't agree more. First, I'd like to get back to your point of a business model. And it's something I do love. My father has a small business and own business. And it's been a totally different experience working for, you know, a local small business, whereas obviously working for a sort of corporate structure. So in that, insofar as how he built up his own small business, and he really did build it up from the ground up. He really did it, seemingly. I mean, unless he had help we don't know about, which I really can't speculate about, because there really doesn't seem to be evidence there. It might be, who knows. But from what evidence is presented, he seemed to build it from the ground up. And that's something, those are really the libertarian values I think we would all want to possess and to espouse, and to go about our own lives trying to, you know, and that's how communities were built up. And people gave meanings to the relationships they have within their communities and the jobs they're able to provide. And I see that with my dad's own small business. You know, he's been able to provide a lot of jobs to people within the community, our own small little community where I live in South Central Pennsylvania. That is, you know, bolstered a lot of people out of jobs right now. And it's been a huge impact. And even though we're going through tough times, everyone kind of goes through these sorts of tough times. But yeah, you know, the cost of it, the cost of building up this sort of plan, and the cost of putting on a show the same way every single time seems to be with his sort of aggressive manner, both is the integrity of the message and his own mental disposition. Watching him over the past 2 years, I think there were times where he, and I can attest to this, just coming into so much information, even myself, and researching a lot of these different topics, there's a lot there. There really is a lot there, but it can be overwhelming. And you can see it with the way sometimes he runs his show. I think it really does seem to get to him. He's human. Mm. There is a human. If you're willing to watch his show, you know, week after week after week, every day, you know, for at least a couple months, what you'll notice is that there will be at least a couple days where it's so obvious, it's all over, just the way he behaves, the way his inflection of his tone and his voice, all of it is just completely, it's very obvious, at least when I was working with Rich and Lisa at Tragedy and Hope, just that it's getting to him, like it gets to anyone. Yeah. When you put too much on yourself, you know, to put the weight of the world at the shoulders, or put, you know, the weight of the world on your shoulders, that, you know, it will crash you over time. And that's where I think, like, in a libertarian perspective, these sorts of individual values, I think a deep breath is needed. And what I mean by a deep breath is a sort of metaphor of analogy to say, take a break. when you're allowing these sorts of things to bring you down. And usually how I notice is how I interact with my family. If I start kind of snapping a little quickly to my family, or I'm a little bit absolute in the way I'm stating certain things, then I know I need to take a break. I know I need to just have some personal time for myself. I think in Alex Jones' case, he can't even do that anymore. He's put such a target on his back, and he claims he did it to protect himself and his family, because now he says if they ever go after him, everyone's going to know it was the government. So he creates this dichotomy over and over again. And these dichotomies build up to a sort of almost anxietal crash that can happen. Now, to his credit, he seems to be decently strong-willed, but God, you know, God knows. It's such a difficult sort of situation. A lot of this is speculation, but I can just tell you from my own personal experience how much a lot of this information, if you really do consider it logically, there is something there. there's something legitimate there, at least from a forensic historical perspective, meaning we're trying to pinpoint the actual tangible, that's where I'm looking for, the tangible evidence in history that we can really build out from and not the sort of speculation that we get from different historians.
Yeah, and I think that it's valuable too as far as a learning experience that Alex can be kind of a mirror for people in a similar situation, especially if we're trying to frequently reach out to other people who are not familiar with this philosophy or with what we do to try and forward it. I was recently having a conversation with an ex, and she said, "Do you still do School Sucks?" And I said, "Yeah." And she said, "Well, don't let it consume you." And I said, why do you think it's consuming me?" She said, "Well, you mentioned it 3 times in 20 minutes of us talking." And I just paused for a second. And I thought about it, and it's not like she's just some completely has no interest, has no passion, sheep of a follower of the mainstream media. She was nothing like that. But a lot of people will really struggle to understand this pursuit because it is just so alien to the world in which we live.
Yeah, there's a self-alienation that happens by coming into this knowledge. Obviously, it's like the first thing whenever you have an experience that seems to transcend a lot of different knowledge sets out there. What's the first thing anyone wants to do being a creature of language? We want to run around and tell everyone.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, it's doesn't work.
Oh, yeah. I remember all these times when I would say to myself, "Oh, if these people just had the information that I do, everything would change." That's not how it works. But the other piece of that was Alex Jones listeners. And, I've made Facebook friends with quite a number of them. And I remember looking at the wall of this one kid I went to high school with, that I went to high school with. And some of his posts related to, Infowars.com are deeply disturbing. And I think that it has the same effect on a listener. If you're consuming, I think you spoke to this, if you're consuming 15 hours of something like Alex Jones each week, that's really just too much. And I know I talked about this earlier as far as like the presentation and the benefit of consuming that much of it is it does have this message of you are small. You are overpowered by these nebulous, well-connected forces that rule the world and have done so for centuries. That's not an empowering message. And I really encourage people to shift more to the personal and away from the Ron Paul and the Federal Reserve and a globalist conspiracy. And not that there's anything wrong with knowing those things, but balance in life is very, very important. And I don't think that the Alex Jones message really encourages that balance. So
yeah, I like to use it as a contrast. It's a sort of contrast to different styles. People respond differently to different rhetorical vehicles, and some people are that sort of type A, sort of aggressive. The personality, not aggressive, but just very much more of a. It's sort of an action-oriented personality where you have to get yourself out there without the sort of reflection. I think some people need that sort of like extra reflection. So when they listen to someone that's much more cool, calm, and collected, and has a willingness to go into the propositions they're stating and say like, "This is how I came to my conclusion," rather than saying, "This is how it just is," I think that presents a big difference. So some people respond differently. Some people like that just like absolute conclusion up front. Some people need to go through the methodical approach, which I tend to find more advantageous because then it's not so emotionally grabbing. And in Alex Jones' case, yeah, I mean, anyone, especially trying to juggle so much in their own lives and coming into these, great, conspiracies, which much of history really is conspiracy, it's the juggling the generalization of what that means for us being in the 21st century in this culture, in this sort of civilization right now. What can we relate that to? What generalizations can we make that are going to be useful for us to know the sort of structure we're coming under and what we can do to either, mitigate those risks or actually make constructive change moving forward? And so I just use them as a contrasting vehicle to different rhetorical options that might be available.
Yeah, and one of the things that I stated at the very beginning of the show is that we wanted to provide some strategies for, if necessary, in your own personal interactions, for those of you listening, how can you put some rhetorical distance between yourself and some of the tactics that Alex Jones uses on his show. So I thought maybe we, in just the last few minutes here, Tony, we could go through a list of some of the things that, I've identified as being relatively common on the Alex Jones show. And my goal being, if somebody says, oh, you're just one of those Alex Jones types, you could say, well, you know, Alex Jones does this. This is certainly not logically sound. And I do have this fear, it is kind of irrational, that if we are able today to use the understanding of the fallacies and a basic understanding of logic to defend ourselves against the mainstream media, who's to say that one day they wouldn't be so wise as to defend themselves against the message of Alex Jones. So Alex Jones, in a way, sticks his neck out and makes a lot of rhetorical and logical errors that I do think need to be pointed out. And yes, as Tony has mentioned several times, Alex Jones does present a lot of really good information on his show. He's done a fantastic job of raising awareness about, you know, the police state elements within the United States government, the expansion of that police state over the course of the last decade. But how do you feel about going through a few of these fallacies that I think are common?
Yeah, sure. Absolutely. Let's go out and see if we can hash them out and give a sort of perspective for the audience out there. So.
Well, we've talked about the appeal to authority and the claim of a higher authority that Alex Jones has, whether he wraps it up in Liberty or he wraps it up in himself or Infowars.com. But a really sloppy example of this is, why don't we call it the appeal to Charlie Sheen, right? So this is more in the realm of the appeal to an improper authority.
Absolutely. And, you know, this actually goes back to Starsuckers, what I was saying earlier about that documentary about the media industry in a way. And, you know, how we build up these improper authorities through media. And, you know, Alex Jones is, in a way, it could be a perfect case of that. Or any celebrity, anyone we give over our lives to and our values to, for them to hand us how we should act, how we should behave, how we should think, how, you know, that's all our culture, this sort of a feedback loop with interacting with our media and the way they present themselves on camera and the way they act, you know, all these different authorities, the way Obama acts, for goodness sake, on TV. It's amazing how much we soak that in. And then we unconsciously almost consider some of the values and some of the considerations that are being made. That's a very good point. I mean, I believe the fallacy is called, from the Latin term, ad verecundium, but it's more proper, in my opinion, to say just the, you know, improper authority, yeah, or just the, you know, fallacy of authority itself. And I like the fact you said improper authority. In some certain cases, obviously, we don't have knowledge sets in all areas of the world. So there's going to be, maybe not the word authority is the great word to use, but there are some people are going to have a knowledge set that's going to help us, a nutritionist or doctor or something, sure, that could potentially help us. And that's why I like that you said improper. You added that sort of adjective there.
Yeah, there's a couple variants of the appeal to authority, but Charlie Sheen is definitely the example of the appeal to an improper authority. I will say this, and gosh, you know, I kind of hope that Alex Jones, this might be brought to his attention one day, but I remember watching one of his documentaries, something I was really excited about seeing. I forget the title, but at the time I was really attracted to whatever the subject of the film was. In the first 15 minutes, he rolls out Gary Busey. Okay? Now, Gary Busey is any factual information that's presented after that is kind of lost on me, because I'm not watching anymore. And it's not because I have a problem with Gary Busey. You know, I understand the man has had a difficult life and some health challenges, but I know enough about, you know, making a meaningful and coherent presentation that if Gary Busey is your second interviewee in a film, you don't know what you're doing, right? You're trying to use bells and whistles and a lot of trickery to convince people. And that was really, it could have just been like, oh, neat. I used to have a cable access show and then a small radio show, and now I have access to Gary Busey. If Gary Busey called me and said, Brad, I want to come on School Sucks podcast, you know, and talk about the craziest thing that you can think of, insert whatever that is here, I'd have Gary Busey on my show from a attraction of listeners standpoint, but I wouldn't tell my audience that Gary Busey is an authority on whatever we're talking about. Maybe an after show, maybe not a regular show. I don't think Gary Busey has anything to offer School Sucks podcast in a regular show, so I certainly wouldn't put him in a documentary.
It is amazing how often, and I'll just leave on this point, when you do filming projects and these are, you know, just even podcasts and what you guys have done with the Thursday Night Show, it's amazing. Well, now Saturday, but it's amazing just the sort of concerns that you get latched to, that sometimes you spend so much time in a certain area and you realize you just have to cut it for the overall how you're supposed to set up the show to get to be clear on the meaning or theme of the show itself. And a lot of times we can allow these sorts of, like, in this case, Gary Busey acting as an authority in this case, like, obviously in that sort of situation, he isn't. And it kind of degrades in the message or theme of what's trying to be presented. So it's important to kind of have, like, in music and symphonies and classical music, especially, is always a theme. And I always say stick to the theme. And, you know, don't try to deviate or go to one specific point that really doesn't attach to the general point you're trying to get across.
Yeah. So. And just to, you know, for the sake of self-promotion here, on what you said about the live show, I've got dozens of hours of footage that is on the website behind a paywall, but it wasn't usable in the show. And it's not that it's bad footage or it's not meaningful. It just didn't serve the purpose that we were trying to achieve in the moment. So Gary Busey makes a great DVD extra. But he's not your second interviewee in a documentary where you're trying to present facts. So that's the appeal to improper authority. Another common one is the argument to ad populum. Alex Jones has frequently cited Zogby polls about 75% of Americans not believing the official story of 9/11. That could be turned around on him very easily in another poll where 85% of, or how about this, 99.9% of everybody who works for the federal government, so now we have the authority rolled into that as well, believes the official story of 9/11 word for word. So that could be turned around and used against him very, very easily.
Yeah, and I think a thing to consider there is how many of us really understand statistical analysis, correlation, regression? When you really get into doing statistics, all of a sudden, like when you have to use symbolic logic essentially in all these different formats for trying to take what we call variables and putting it into a computer system, my goodness, whole bunch of the crazy things can happen. And that's where a lot of the conclusions fallaciously come from, these statistical models. It's very difficult to argue from a statistical model unless you really understand that the statistics are proper and they've taken the proper population size and the covariance in the system and all these different factors that seem otherworldly complex, you know, to us. To jump back to saying ad populum, one of my favorite fallacies, it's probably the one employed by our families and friends the most, just the appeal to how it's always done. It's always done this way. It's, you know, we've always believed it this way. We've always done this ritual this way. So it has to, we just have to continue it. We all know it's kind of, obtuse and perverse, but like, why would we change it? Everyone else already does it. It's something that drives me nuts. I have to admit, it's one of my favorite fallacies, but the one I might notice the most or experience the most is this sort of appeal to popular tradition, popular belief, popular whatever.
Sure.
And truly moving a movement of going along with the collective.
Yeah, absolutely. One more that I think is worth touching on, often referred to as the existential fallacy. So the definition of that is any argument whose conclusion implies that a class has at least one member, but whose premises do not so imply. So I know that's a little confusing. An example that's given is all trespassers will be prosecuted. Therefore, some of those prosecuted will have trespassed. I think the way that this most often shows up in Alex Jones's presentation, I often refer to, usually maybe mislabeled on my part, as confirmation bias. So Alex Jones will usually do the conspiracy that there is a small group of people plotting against you as a starting point, and he will try to fill in the rest of the story from there. Because now, is there an emotional benefit for him? Is there a financial benefit for him for doing that? So yeah, at this point, after, you know, almost two decades of doing this, that might just be an automatic process. But this is a little different than the confirmation bias, because I think what I referred to this when we talked about Alex Jones before in an after show was the pile-on approach. So the Piers Morgan interview that we started talking about was really an example of a pile-on approach, where Alex Jones or one of his defenders will say, well, I just wanted to throw out as much stuff as possible. But that's exactly the same tactic that Piers Morgan is using when he goes after these supposedly pro-self-defense people, is he is just peppering them with question after question. There's no follow-up question. There's no conversation. It's just very robotic. He's just going to throw as much stuff out there until he can hopefully get something to stick. So Alex Jones will do this thing where he starts one of his speeches with the phrase, "We have." And then he'll go into a list as if what follows will be a coherent assembly of evidence. So when he's talking about 9/11, he'll say, "We have Hitler firebombing his own Reichstag building." That has nothing to do with 9/11. Now, I understand the argument that you could say, yes, it's a historical context for governments using false flag operations to bring about tyranny, but it is not evidence that supports the idea that 9/11 was carried out by some element within the United States government. So Alex Jones often winds up throwing so many things at the wall that if you evaluate each piece of evidence individually, this is very true with 9/11 because it's such a massively complex event that different pieces of information will wind up in some ways contradicting each other. And if somebody and there have been films.
And if you go to the truth movement, I'm sorry to cut you in there, but just go to the truth movement and see all the different ideas that people are trying to justify as the truth of what happened. It's all over the place. Mm-hmm. It is amazing what has built up, not just in the mainstream of this is the conclusion we got, but then even in the so-called truth movement, all the different agendas and all the different sorts of games that are being played to justify all these different conclusions. It becomes a circus.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, really, simply put, this is kind of like everything is a conspiracy. Everything is part of a conspiracy. So this is a conspiracy. This is a thing that happened. So it's a conspiracy.
That's well said. Yeah, you can kind of confuse it. Though I pulled my logic book when you said the existential fallacy. I'm like, ooh, this is a tough one. This is an interesting one. And in my Socratic logic book by Peter Crave, too, he has a whole agenda himself, but he does a great job of very succinctly explaining some of the basic tenets of logic. Here he has the existential fallacy, confusing essence and existence. Now, I don't want to get too deep into what essence is and existence, but it is interesting in a way, like the essence of this conspiracy theory needs to be proved by this, you know, these existential events, you know, these events that actually do exist and have happened in history or are happening right now. But, you know, essence is a totally different thing in logic and how we use to abstract these sort of general concepts. So that's a whole thing in itself. It's under the term of a metaphysical fallacy, which is interesting because that's like a sort of foundational concept to any philosophy. So, but yeah, you're right. I mean, in this way, what he's doing is he's taking the essence of conspiracy theory and he's trying to take all these specific instances and trying to justify it. And it seems a lot rather logical throughout the whole process, but he's not actually moving it to this other event that does exist or has existed that we're pinpointing it to. We're pinpointing it to this idea or this essence of conspiracy, this overarching general apotheosizing of this grandiose authority that's handing out and guiding the way investment and policies should be done. And it's interesting to note that. That's a wonderful fallacy. Good call, Brett. I like that.
There's one more, too. And I don't know if this has an actual Latin name or what type of fallacy it is, but it's pretty common and it's pretty problematic as well. It is an important question to ask. Qui bono? Who benefits from something? But the fact that you're able to identify a beneficiary. I did see an article where this was just called the argument from benefit, but I haven't really seen that anywhere else, and I'm not familiar with it. Asking the question of who benefits, if somebody benefits, therefore they are guilty. So let's just use 9/11, and let's just take the devil's advocate position of I believe the official story. What did the government make for everyone who believed the official story of 9/11? It was like a coloring book. Do you remember that?
No, I don't.
No, comic book. I'm sorry, it was a comic book. I always think of it as a coloring book.
A coloring book.
Reason.
That's even better. That's really a better analogy in a way. Color it in.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, color in all the different fallacies, if you will. So, about all the, or just the, when, well, we could talk endlessly about 9/11, but just the, you know, the foundational, what people should be going on is how a crime scene should be conducted. Look at it from that perspective.
Absolutely.
What would a forensics officer do at a crime scene, and, you know, and see if the same procedures were carried out at 9/11. I think that's a good place to start. But sorry, go ahead.
Right. So Alex Jones, instead of, I mean, and I'm, to his credit, he has also at other times gone through this process. But if I'm on the other side of that argument, which I'm really not, but if I'm on the other side, if I'm trying to debunk Alex Jones, and Alex Jones makes a definitive declaration that says, look, the U.S. government benefited greatly from 9/11. That is true. The Middle Eastern world, the people that the mainstream viewpoint accuses of being responsible for 9/11, and there's all kinds of fallacies inside that as well. That's, you know, collectivizing. But the Middle East doesn't benefit from 9/11. They get invaded and bombed. But the American government benefits. Therefore, they are responsible. But there is a way to turn that around and say that elements within the Middle Eastern world, once we get away from that fallacy of collectivizing the Middle East is responsible for 9/11, which was, of course, very popular with the Bush administration and its supporters when they bombed Iraq and all that. But there are elements in the Middle East that benefit greatly from 9/11. The United States is pulled into Afghanistan using basically the model that the CIA taught the Mujahideen as far as how to subvert the Soviets. So all of these resources are being dumped into this endless, unwinnable war that can be fought very cheaply with 1970s, shoulder-mounted grenade launchers against million-dollar American aircraft, billion-dollar American technology. So it's this real time and money sink and sink of human lives for the Americans, but their supposed enemy, Al-Qaeda, can fight the war on the cheap on their home turf. So there are elements that benefit greatly if 9/11 was carried out by this, quote unquote, Al-Qaeda group. So that is an effective debunking in just this way that Alex Jones, exposes himself to that kind of dismissal of what is a much better researched argument against the official story of 9/11, but allows it all to be cut down by sticking a sloppy example like that out there for somebody to take apart very easily.
Yeah, I think, you kind of hit it earlier when you said, I don't know if you said this, but I'm thinking of fallacies of association. In this case, I'm thinking of endless fallacies of association where we're associating a certain event or certain situation with a certain ideology. It could be endless forms of association of the mind itself. The way we actually access memory oftentimes is actually associational. It doesn't happen in the sort of hierarchical categorization of rational thought. That is also a natural process of the mind, but how we recall from memory is actually by association. This is something that's recently been empirically researched by psychologists and scientists. But the idea essentially is and I'm sure you've heard this, where you might smell a certain smell and all of a sudden it triggers an event of a memory that happened. And that's kind of how our brains actually work when we associate, certain events with certain things. And in a way, Alex Jones is, trying to reinforce his position by creating these fallacies of association instead of actually setting up these propositions and seeing there's a causal nature between what he's saying. And I think it's important all around. I think he did a great job showing how you can argue from both sides then, and associate from both sides exactly how it could benefit or not benefit each side. And then you can get into a certain level of granularity and detail where it can become so complex at that point that you almost lose the efficacy of the argument altogether or the association. So,
yeah. Any final thoughts on this?
First of all, I'd like to thank you for the opportunity to be on your show. I had a wonderful time, and this is a very interesting discussion. Like you said, it's very timely. I think it would have been a bit, obviously, with what happened, unfortunately, in November, actually in the early December, was a tragedy beyond belief. And unfortunately, I think the problem with that, what happens with that, is the sort of emotional attachments that we then cling to, especially during a time we're supposed to be your friends and family. So it's important that I think we took the time to, and it gave it time. And we're not talking about that specific event as much as we're talking about what's the fallout now of that event and what's happening in the mainstream media and the perspectives. Obviously, I think we've discussed with friends and family just over the holidays of what people believe and what's happening. So I think it's timely that now when we're just getting in more to the logical argumentation and the facts, that we can actually, try to hash out some of these inconsistencies on both sides of what's happening.
Yeah, when I first heard the news of the Newtown shooting, I was alone in my car, so I wasn't being initially overstimulated by exposure to mainstream media or the Facebook debate or the Facebook philosophical or ideological victory laps of, oh, not enough guns, or oh, too much guns. I was just kind of alone with my thoughts and really felt, obviously sad because it's a terrible tragedy, but I have to admit I was to some extent overcome by fear, not of, is this some kind of Operation Gladio staged event to bring about, a gun grab, but what is the public reaction going to be? How incoherent is the public debate going to be? And, how quiet are our voices going to be in that debate? So yeah, I think this is timely because I think things took a turn in the wrong direction with Alex's appearance on Piers Morgan earlier this week. And I hope this has been helpful to maybe put some distance between the word liberty and Alex Jones. And, not that to give Alex Jones the benefit of the doubt, maybe he believes that this is what he's advocating for, but it's not so simple and the approach, the tactics, tragic in many ways, and really not in the long term going to be effective with a great number of people. So, Tony, I do want to point out that you are featured on the new site under the About tab on the website. There is a section called Voices, and you can get a link to all shows Tony has been in there. So I want to thank you very much for your participation, and hopefully we can do it again in the future.
Absolutely. Anytime. I really enjoy being on this, and I've always been a big supporter of your show, so I'm just thankful for the opportunity.
Okay, I don't go, oh, great, I'm on TV, oh, I'm in thousands of newspapers. It's like, oh, man, great, now I've really got to watch what I say. I mean, this is about defeating the globalist. That's what I want. I mean, I wouldn't be up here putting it all on the line, calling for Second American Revolution peacefully before it gets violent. I said that because I can see they're going to make their move. We got to get real aggressive or we're going to lose it. But, oh, Piers Morgan and Becker are like, don't be aggressive. Sit down and shut up. They always tell constitutionalists, libertarians, quote, conservatives that. And it's like hours of this Glenn Beck stuff. We're going to try to condense it down to a few minutes. I'm a liar. I sit on a pile of lies. I'm a fascist. I'm spooky. I'm scary. I'm fat. And he's saying, don't believe Alex. Don't listen to him. You know, this man shouldn't be popular. Same thing Piers Morgan's saying. Because you guys are establishment, okay? And, you know, I pray to God that I don't have a bad temper. I pray to God that I can tell the truth and be accurate. I'm not perfect, but you know what? I don't like people saying I'm a liar on purpose and that I'm a bad person and that I want a violent revolution. If we don't say, hey, don't try it and get the word out and say a takeover is illegitimate, there's going to be one.
What I haven't heard is one coherent reason why any civilian in America needs an AR-15 military-style assault weapon. Tell me why you need one.
I told you why the general population of America, law-abiding citizens,
why do they need those weapons?
They need them for the prospective possibility of resistance to tyranny, which is not a concern today. It may not be a concern tomorrow.
Where are you expecting the tyranny to come from?
It could come from the United States, because governments have gone tyrannical before.
Do you understand how absurd you sound when you say that?
Here's where you go into the absurd and the bullying. You're absurd. You're stupid. I understand that.
I'm not the one that came in here and accused you of standing on the graves of dead children.
Because there's one who's doing that.
Bullying.
Punching back twice as hard.
That's what I call bullying.
And this is astonishing.
What's astonishing?
What's astonishing about it is that for weeks now, you have been saying that anybody who disagrees with your position is absurd, idiotic, and doesn't care about the dead kids in Sandy Hook. And then when I say that that's a bully tactic, you turn around and say, I'm bullying you for saying that. It's absurd. It's ridiculous.
Let me ask you again. What is the point of a civilian having an AR-15 assault weapon?
This is Brett, and in case you haven't heard, I would like you to pay me $6 a month for doing School Sucks Podcast. Now, I know some of you are saying, Brett, no. But others might be asking, $6 a month, what are you going to do to earn it? Well, let me start by telling you this. In 2012, the number of monthly subscribers grew by almost 100%. And as a result of that growth, I had the time and resources necessary to produce more shows, release more videos, grow our YouTube subscribers by over 100%. I increased podcast listeners by almost 40% and debuted a live call-in show on Ustream and LRN.fm. But now, with the new website at schoolsucksproject.com, all subscribers get access to a bonus content section called the AV Club. Now, some of you might be saying, Brett, that's probably just you and your friends effing around. But that couldn't be further from the truth. How about a little peek at what's inside? Drop the beat. Everybody knows. Role play.
I asked you a question.
Yeah, but why? Who are you? I don't understand what's happening.
Do you see this badge on my chest?
So you are airport security?
Sir, I work for the transportation security asshole.
That's not what it stands for.
Men's health issues.
If my brain wasn't evolved enough to handle as much porn as I watch, how would I be able to watch that much porn and not have exploded by now?
Well, very rarely will you see a man explode.
Experimental radio.
I'm Gardner Goldsmith along with Brett.
That's never been done before.
Political science.
All a dog will ever make is poop, and all bureaucrats ever make when they're at work is government.
Regular science.
I have a disease that makes me turn into a bat.
science fiction.
Now, I love Doctor Who, but his explanations are so cockamamie.
History.
Abraham Lincoln spent a lot of time around logs.
I learned that in school.
Yeah, he also had a giant blue ox named Babe.
And he freed the slave.
Foreign affairs. The Russians.
Remember them?
Yeah.
Huh.
They'll be back.
Friendships.
Okay, we are back.
Yeah! Fuck you.
Interviews.
What do you like to do? What are you calling for?
I like to giggle.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Me too.
Philosophers interviewing dead terrorists in heaven.
I have a question for Osama. So, according to certain interpretations of Islamic law, you get 72 virgins in heaven. What I don't understand is that in heaven, I don't think anybody ages. Like, you don't get older because you're never going to die. So nothing about your body changes. So isn't it the case that these women are going to stay virgins for the rest of time?
Osama hates that. Osama has 72 virgins, and they just keep telling me that they love me. They always text me, "I love you, Osama," and put a little smiley face at the end.
That's good to know. It's good to get that kind of feedback on what's going on in heaven there.
Presidential wisdom.
Three words. Transdimensional lizard Jews.
Snakes on a plane.
Snakes on a plane! Oh, shit! Snakes on a plane!
You guys are great!
Liberals.
I really suggest you check out a book. It's written by Professor Richard Crabtree. It's called How I Know Everything About Why the Free Market Doesn't Work, Even Though I Never Spent 5 Minutes of My Career Outside of Academia. Volume 1.
And of course, the behind-the-scenes planning of some of our greatest moments.
I'm gonna make him get up and face somebody and pretend like he's showing them his and then that later that person gives him a job and they get married. It should be Kokesh.
This is gonna be an absolute train wreck, dude.
So don't settle for some corny 4-minute ad that takes reputable people out of context in a comically misleading way, like this.
Do we want a giant mommy state or do we want a giant daddy state? Because what else is there?
Right. And this.
They demolish the buildings with lasers from the sky.
And this.
And we're going to make sure all businesses supply hardcore porn. You know what I mean?
No, instead, get in there. There's over 150 hours of additional content. And even if you don't have time to listen to it all, which nobody does, once in a while it's okay to go on a little internet treasure hunt. So go to schoolsucksproject.com and click on the support tab.
I'm Newt Gingrich, and I endorse this message.
Thank you for your participation.